from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Today I'm joined by recent six-string concerts guest Nikki Mehta from the Wailing Jennies to talk about songwriting and what she thinks success is. I'll also talk to Bill Russell, lyricist for the Catco musical The Last Smoker in America, which is presently having its world premiere in Columbus. That's all coming up from Writer's Talk from The Ohio State University. Nikki Mehta, tell me about how you do writing for the Wailing Jennies. What is your method? How do you all work together? And part of that is you have a new member of the group.
We do, yes. Heather Massey, although she's been with the band for over 4 years now, so she's the newest, but not terribly new. But as far as writing goes in the band, I mean, the band's almost 9 years old, and we've never really written together. We've talked about it. But it's never actually happened except for this latest album that's about to come out. Heather and I collaborated on some lyrics for one of her songs. So that's been the only co-write actually so far. And typically the way that we do it, writing in general, is, you know, we each will bring a complete song to the band and then we just arrange it together with harmonies and with other instrumentation, which is a really creative process in and of itself. But in terms of actually writing the songs themselves, that's more of a solitary process, and people bring things that are fairly whole. You know, sometimes people will make suggestions about, you know, maybe this might be a better lyric here, or I think it would be better if you chopped out this bar here. It feels a little long or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. So, but yeah, we're all songwriters. So we just, you know, bring a bunch of stuff in and see what sticks.
You talked about that you might say take out a bar here or a bar there, but you don't talk to each other about the lyrics themselves. Huh, that's interesting. You don't say, I think this story would be better told this way or that way or a different rhyme. It's all solitary.
Well, no, we do make comments about each other's lyrics. Like we might say that, you know, this, I think you might want to say this slightly differently, or this is, you know, whatever, this, we have made comments on each other's lyrics. So that happens too. Yep. Yeah. Not a ton, but it does happen.
Tell me about your favorite song that you've written for the band and why that one particularly resonates with you.
Oh, that's hard. That's like,
I know, it's choosing among your favorite children.
It is. That's exactly what it is. And it's hard because they all occupy different things in the show. Like if we're performing them live, or actually even if we're not, they have different functions. So it's like one of my new songs because it's an upbeat song and it's a lot of fun to play. But, you know, something like a song like Begin, which is off Firecracker, that feels very emotional to play, which I appreciate, and it seems to connect with a lot of people, and I have a lot of people commenting on that, and so I feel like that in terms of a connection with the audience, that's probably, you know, my favorite, if not, or one of my favorites, if not my favorite, of the songs that I've written for the band on that level. So it's hard to say one, but if I had to pick one off the top of my head, I would say Begin is probably one.
Was there a song that you've written that you felt was a particular breakthrough for you as a songwriter, or particularly difficult to write because of the emotional impact of it? You had talked about that the song as being connecting well with your mm-hmm. audience, but is there one that was like that for you that really changed? Bruce Springsteen talks about the song The River as the song that made him realize that that was what he wanted to mm-hmm. do. Those were the kinds of songs he wanted to write. Have you had a breakthrough like that, or has it been a more gradual kind of advancement?
There have been different kinds of breakthroughs. There's I think Arlington is the first song that I ever wrote that I felt was a folk song, because I come from much more of a pop background, and Arlington was one of the first songs I wrote after the Jennies got together. And I think, not that I consciously sought, you know, to write a folk song per se, but I felt like I had been influenced enough at that point by what I knew of the tradition, and sort of, I think it feels the folkiest to me out of anything I had written to that point, and probably maybe even have still written.
Do you know?
then I think in terms of, there's sometimes that you feel as a songwriter like you're, you know, not really quite hitting the nail on the head with a song. You know, you're trying to say something and you feel like maybe it's not as a sort of, I don't know, it doesn't really hit the mark quite the way you want it to. And I feel like there's a new song of mine that's coming out on the new album that speaks on a theme that I've written a lot about, which is just sort of the mystery of the life cycle, the mystery of death and birth. And not that I profess to know anything about that, but I sort of feel like in terms of what I wanted to say about it, I actually said it the way I wanted to say it in this particular song.
And which song?
It's called Away But Never Gone. And it was written for a friend who passed away, but it was also written for my babies when I was pregnant. And so it sort of has a theme of birth and death. And it was written as a lullaby, so it has a sort of more of a childlike theme, but bigger issues. And I sort of feel like that this song has been more successful. I feel the wind blowing slowly changing time. I'd like to be the wind that swirls and shapes the sky. I smell the flowers blooming, opening for spring. I'd like to be those flowers open to everything.
Tell me about your feelings about how the landscape has changed since you started, especially for songwriters. Is it different for songwriters to get into songwriting now? Is it harder? Is it about the same? Easier? What's your advice for people starting out?
You know, in some ways it's easier. In some ways it's harder. I think the whole industry has changed dramatically because of the digital age, as many people have realized. I mean, when I got into music, and I mean, it wasn't even really that long ago, it was 12 years ago that I got into doing this as a career. And at that time, distribution companies were fully functional and doing well. You know, and record labels were in good shape at that point. And so that's not a long time for things to kind of completely change, and they have. You know, most of the distribution companies I know have folded, and a lot of the labels are in trouble. So, you know, there's things, but I mean, what that does is, you know, it makes it harder on the one hand to get physical CDs out there, but it makes it easier to get yourself out in a digital way on you know, whether it's on iTunes or however you might want to release it. It's just, I think the trick has always been for songwriters is to get their songs heard. So nothing has changed in that respect. You have to tour, and that's been the case. I guess just now it's even more important to tour for us, for songwriters, singer-songwriters, because that's where you're selling your CDs too. And people are hearing you and you're building your name for yourself. So there's certain things that have changed and certain things that haven't. And I don't know that it's any more difficult than it was. I guess the only thing is it's become, technology has made it easier for more people to release music. And so you're probably having to, you know, wade through a little bit more out there, you know, and, you know, it's more of a do-it-yourself kind of thing these days in some respects, but you know, you have to make your mark, and that can be tricky. But I would say to anybody as advice to singer-songwriters, I mean, people who have a passion for this, and you have to have a passion for it because it's a lot of hard work with no guarantee, and so you have to love it, is just to be true to your own voice. Don't try and be like anybody else. There's way too many copycats out there, and that's just not, you know, everybody has something interesting to say from their own perspective and their own voice, you know? So I encounter a lot of people who want to sing like another singer or who want to write like another writer. Write your own stuff and sing how you sing, and that's your best bet.
How did you work your way into that? A lot of people start off not wanting to own their own voice. Was that ever a problem with you when you're singing or you're songwriting? I mean, there's a lot of people who don't want to listen to themselves on tape, for mm-hmm. example, and have to get past all that. And at some point, somebody like me, as you get older, you say, who cares? Mm-hmm. to some respect. And so that's sort of how some people get over stage fright or worrying about the sound of that voice. Was that something that you had to work through, or was it not?
Well, I don't particularly like listening to myself or watching myself. I mean, that's a really good tool, actually, to become a better singer and a better performer. I'm just not a fan of it. I kind of sort of cringe. But I You know, for me, I never intended on having a career in music. It wasn't a sort of a lifelong dream of mine, and so that's kind of helpful, I think. I'm glad that I didn't want, you know, I didn't have this huge desire to do it, because I think I would have probably wrecked it for myself. But it just sort of, it was kind of, just kind of happened in some ways. I mean, I'd always been playing music, but I, you know, always thought I'd go to, I'd always thought I'd, you know, do a master's and a PhD and be a professor. That was what I thought I was going to do. And so it kind of happened very organically to me, and I didn't even have a chance to try and fabricate some sort of image or some, you know, a voice that I thought would be attractive. And that doesn't mean that, you know, along the way, you know, you see sometimes what other artists are doing, and you admire what they're doing. And you sometimes, I think, feel like you wish you could write something like that. And so maybe that acts as an inspiration. But I very much, in those instances, tried to just trust what I bring to the table, you know, and mm-hmm. and value that. And that can be a little bit of a struggle sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's been very organic for me. I'm very lucky that way, I think.
How do you get past all the distractions? Say the telephone mm-hmm. ringing or the baby crying. Mm-hmm. How do you work through those kinds of things? Because that's a common difficulty and a common way that people sometimes just can't get things out because there are too many other things, especially technological. What's your secret for being able to write among all the clamor of modern day?
Well, I mean, it's a time management thing, really. I think most successful musicians will tell you that a large majority of what we do is business, particularly if you take on a lot of the work yourself. You know, we're still a independent grassroots kind of band, and we manage ourselves now. You know, we have people that book our shows, and we have record labels and stuff, but we do a lot of the management. I mean, we do all the management ourselves. We have employees, you know, that it's a lot of work. And I'm a mother of twins, so it's, you know, mm-hmm. it's a lot of juggling. And sadly, if anything gets left behind, it's the writing, because there's always a ton of business to do. But you have to make room for that, and you have to manage your time well. And that's, you know, that can be tricky. It's not easy. But at the same time, when you have, like, you know, my boys are the best thing in the world to me, and they provide plenty of inspiration. So you have to have a life outside of music as well in order to be able to write about anything. So I think that trying to find the balance can be hard, but you have to have inspiration for the music in the first place. As long as you create some space for it, then all of that busyness can turn into something good.
Well, Nikki Mehta from the group Wailing Jennies, thank you very much for talking to me today. And we look forward to seeing you in town.
Great. We're looking forward to it ourselves.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Lyricist and writer Bill Russell received 2 Tony nominations for Sideshow, co-wrote Pageant, and wrote elegies for Angels, Punks, and Raging Queens, and Lucky Duck. He's working on a new show, The Last Smoker in America, which is on its way to New York. Welcome to Writer's Talk,
Thanks
Bill
very
Russell.
Much. Great. Great to be here.
Well, The Last Smoker in America, it's a 90-minute, one-act musical comedy with a live rock band. Walk me through the development of the piece. Tell me what it's about. How did you come up to write it?
Well, it's set in the very near future, tomorrow, when anti-smoking laws are becoming more and more draconian. During the course of the show, it goes from social ostracism and heavy fines to a year in prison and then 20 years in prison for smoking. And the lead character, Pam, who is an English comp professor, just cannot quit. That's the basic idea of the plot. The development of it has been quite long and roundabout. It started as a one act and gradually developed into a full-length show.
Okay. And I like the fact that you're doing an English comp professional as somebody with this with an addiction that would be punishable by 20 years in prison.
Right.
You hear that, English people? So tell me, I mean, were you looking for some sort of comment then, I think, on just the treatment of smokers in the U.S., or is it about public policy? What got you interested?
It's really about personal freedom and where your freedom impinges on mine. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, we've had a long development process of this, and we've done readings, and we did a showcase production last year at the New York Musical Theater Festival. And smokers think it's about them, and anti-smokers think it's about them. So I actually like that a lot.
Okay. Why do you think that is? I mean, why do you think they're taking to heart in so many, in such radically different ways?
Well, it's, I think there is a certain amount of ambiguity about it. It's not, doesn't come down clearly on one side or the other of the issue. It's just exploring the questions that arise from these kinds of issues of personal freedom.
Okay. Now, you've talked about doing readings and having a lot of different revisions to the
yes.
play. Tell me about some of the revisions. What happens when you're produced starting on it, this show, and how does it get revised? What leads you to revise?
Well, we've been working on this for over 6 years, and I've done over 50 drafts of it.
So tell me what each draft changed. Go ahead.
It is an original musical, and it's a comedy, both of which are challenging in their own ways. And, you know, in the process of hearing it in front of audiences, you find out, especially with the comedy, what's landing and what isn't. But also in terms of the overall form, what songs are really working and what is needed for different songs. So there's been a lot of revising of that, cutting songs, replacing them with other songs, adding new songs. And it takes a long time to work that out.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a different sort of process than it used to be, right? I mean, you can go out of town and then come back to New York or to Broadway with a different show, but has that always historically been the way that Broadway treated musicals?
Or? I think there was always a lot of revision. I think it tended to happen more quickly in the past because typically musicals tried out of town, and a lot of work was done there. Now there's such a long development process with workshops and readings and showcases that more of the work happens before you even get to the stage of going out of town.
Mm-hmm. Why is there so much more now? Why is it such a longer process?
Well, I think it's a very expensive hobby to pursue.
Hobby. Is that how you pronounce it? You tell people,
profession.
I don't work.
I'm a hobby. No, I have an avocation and a vocation. But ever since Chorus Line, which started the whole process of workshopping musicals, because they are so expensive and right. very few musicals go out of town anymore because it's just too much money to do that. So the process has changed over the years.
Okay. And, you know, when you're talking about musicals, it always comes down to you're the lyricist and right. there's some, well, I mean, people like Sondheim do both,
right.
which is crazy. But how do you work with a lyricist? How do you work with a composer?
Right.
You've worked with a couple different composers. You're working with Peter Melnick on this one.
Yes.
You've worked with two other musical, one acts with him, Patter for the Floating Lady and A Bad Spell.
Right.
So you've got this process.
Right.
Tell me about the process.
Well, interestingly enough, all the composers I work with prefer to start with the lyric, and that's somewhat unusual. Mm. But it's different with each one. But for instance, I've written four musicals with Henry Krieger, the composer of Dreamgirls. And with him, I will work on a lyric by myself in the morning. Not necessarily write a whole lyric, but come with something, a verse and a refrain, say. I go down to his apartment in the afternoon. He won't look at it. We've discussed who the character is singing it in the moment and a possible feel sometimes, but he takes it. He sits down at the piano. He puts the lyric on the piano, puts his keys on the keyboard, and then looks up and starts playing as he reads it for the first time. And I would say 60% of the time, what happens in that moment is defines what that song is. Mm-hmm. Now, then we work on it. You know, we play it thousands of times. And if I haven't written a whole lyric, for instance, he might then write a musical section that follows what I've written. So I set lyrics to that. So it does go back and forth a lot. In this particular show, there's a song that had a completely different title and a completely different lyric, and I love the music, but for plot reasons we had to change the lyric, so I completely rewrote it.
So you'll change everything. You'll revise something even as big as the plot. You know, it had a happy ending before. Now it's a sad ending.
Hugely, yes.
Okay, what are your boundaries on that? Is there anything you haven't done that you, or do you ever flip backwards and say, you know what, I like this better the other way?
Oh, yes, that happens sometimes.
How do you know when you've hit on the thing that you want?
It's just instinctual. And of course, with a show, you get a lot of feedback from, you know, a director, audiences, whoever, set designers. Everybody has feelings about it, and it's great. I appreciate that input. And you get a sense of people don't often have the solution, but they're great at identifying the problems.
Okay. So, I mean, one of the areas where there's a lot of writing in theater is criticism.
Yes.
What's your take on criticism? Some people read it. Some people refuse to read it. Does it ever occur to you, okay, this guy's got a point or this woman has a point, let's incorporate that into the show?
I wish I could refuse to read it, but I can't. But absolutely, sometimes I read reviews that make points that make a lot of sense to me. I just had a show in London Elegies for Angels, Punks, and Raging Queens. It's an AIDS piece, which I essentially wrote 20 years ago, but it does get revived a lot. And I added some new material for this London production. And one of the critics really made some excellent points about it that I took to heart.
Now, that one is based off your reading, or so it's a revision, or it has in mind Spoon River Anthology.
Correct. Right? I was inspired by that.
Yeah. Right, which is all about like a small town and all the people in it who are sort of, I think, speaking from the grave, informing on each other.
Exactly.
So tell me how that worked its way into that musical. It's a one act, right? It's these testimonials, confessionals of people who have died from AIDS.
Right. Well, I was very familiar with Spoon River, and I've written free verse all my life. I was looking to do a longer piece in that form, and in 1987, I was at the initial unveiling of the Names Project Quilt in Washington, and I had the idea to transfer Edgar Lee Masters' cemetery in Spoon River to the AIDS quilt as the metaphor, you know, shaping this piece, and to write free verse monologues in the voices of people who had died from AIDS in the way that he wrote in the voices of the people from that town who were in the cemetery.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of these are based on people you knew. You said some of them are based on stories, things like that. What, when you get feedback on something like this, you can get feedback from people that say, you know what, I knew this person and that wasn't the way I want to remember him, or that wasn't the way. Has that happened? And then what do you do?
I can't say so much of that, but the most common response I hear from that is you should have one about, because it's impossible to cover the subject of AIDS, you know, in just 30 monologues and all the experiences that people had. I can't say that because I don't know that most people would recognize the people that are real stories.
Okay. Yeah. As you said, you're traveling with the show.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons that you're here. What kind of influence do you get to make as the writer? You've got the director. The director is telling people, okay, do this, do that. And you're sitting there going, you know what, that's not what I had in mind for this. Or I want to see the stage direction done in another way. What happens when they contravene a stage direction?
You know, I have a wonderful relationship with our director, Andy Sandberg.
Oh, that's too bad. I was really hoping for something else.
So, I mean, we have a very, you know, he is so smart, and he has given such incredible notes on the writing, and he's very open to my notes on the direction. Mm-hmm. But I don't have that many. I really like what he's doing, and I love being surprised by directors. I just came from the theater, and there's all this set stuff that I never saw in my head that it's so cool, and it's so exciting to see it now.
But at the same time, you've also directed a number.
Yes.
Of your own. And does this led you to revise anything? Because I'm curious about, you've got a show, it's run, you've seen somebody else direct it, then you come back later on and you're going to direct a different version of your show.
Right.
So at some level, you're influenced by what these people have done, but you also want to go in your own direction. Tell me about that experience for you as the writer, then getting to do everything.
Right. Well, I tend not to direct my own stuff on its initial outing, because if a rewrite is needed, I don't want to have to be thinking about what the lights are doing. Mm-hmm. But I often direct my own pieces after they have been established. And of course, I'm very influenced by the way they were originally directed. But I think a good show is open to a lot of interpretations. And, of course, the circumstances are always different. So, and the casts are different. Elegies is a piece that I've directed many times with many different actors all over the world. And I still, even though I wrote it, I still, as a director with them, find new things in the monologues because they bring new things to it. So that's a very exciting process to me.
And that sounds like it's must be a very positive thing when they bring these new things.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm also curious about the other side. When they do something and you're like, you know, this points up to me that here's a part where I may need to rewrite. I didn't see that before. And what's that process like for you?
Well, you know, Tennessee Williams famously said that plays aren't so much finished as abandoned. And I very much feel that. And I keep coming back to my shows for different reasons. I like to think they're done, but they never really are. Show Lucky Duck, which I wrote with Henry Krieger, just this summer we were asked to adapt it as a piece for young audiences, and it really wasn't written with that in mind. But we were happy to do it, and in doing so, we made a lot of discoveries about it.
How did you revise it for young audiences? What did you have to change?
Well, it had to be 70 minutes without an intermission, and they said, you know, the kids won't really sit still for many ballads, so we had to cut most of those. And there was a certain adult edge to it. It is a fairy tale. It's a wacky version of the Ugly Duckling idea, but we had to cut back on some of our warped sensibilities.
Well, you've got a talent scout named Wolf, who takes on the Ugly Duckling as a fashion model, but claims he no longer eats meat.
Right.
So there may be some problems with this.
Yeah.
You've also done a show called Sideshow.
Yes.
And it was about a conjoined set of twins.
Yes.
Tell me about writing that. What got you interested in the topic?
Well, it's based on a true story of the Hilton sisters, who were stars of vaudeville in the 30s. During the height of the Depression, they were making $4,000 a week, which would be $40,000 a week now, at least. They made two movies, Todd Browning's Freaks, they appeared in when they were quite young and gorgeous. And then they made this terrible movie in the 50s called Chained for Life, which is how we discovered them. Mm-hmm. The director of Sideshow saw that movie and said, we should write a musical about this. It's these conjoined twins. They sing, they dance, they play musical instruments. And I immediately said, that is a great idea. Because I was just fascinated by the thought of two actors singing and dancing together on stage. I thought that was inherently theatrical.
And they were nominated for the Tonys. And if they were nominated as one role.
Yes.
So they would have won conjoined Tonys. two Tonys with their name on it.
Right.
On it. What is it like for the actors in that particular thing? You've got a vision that they're going to be conjoined. Tell me about how that physically worked out on stage.
Well, it was interesting because we had always thought when we were writing it that they would be physically connected by costumes. One of the first people we showed any of it to was Robin Wagner, who's a very well-established Broadway scene designer from Hair and Chorus Line, Dreamgirls, up to Hairspray. No, he didn't do Hairspray, sorry. But he said, I think having them connected by costumes would be kind of grotesque, and it's the theater, the audience should create that connection. So we've always done it with them just standing side by side. But it is so convincing, and they dance, they do everything. In the Broadway production, I'd be in the lobby at intermission and hear people say, oh, that one time they turned and I saw the Velcro. Well, there was no Velcro. They were just so good at it. And the women who play those roles, Henry always said, because of his experiences with Dreamgirls, they will hate each other. But it's been absolutely the opposite. They always love each other, and after rehearsal, they miss having the other actor at their hip.
Well, they've also, the original two people that were nominated for Tonys went on to record a couple different albums of duets together.
Right.
So they've, that at least worked well.
Oh, yes, yes. You know, and they've both done very well. Alice Ripley won the Tony last year for Next to Normal, and Emily Skinner is coming back to Broadway right now in Billy Elliot.
For more from my guests, Nikki Mehta of the Wailing Jennies and Bill Russell, lyricist of The Last Smoker in America, and for links to their projects, visit www.writerstalk.org.
Writers Talk is a co-production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing and the Ohio Channel, where you can see videos of our author interviews at www.ohiochannel.org. Join us next time for Karen Kassler and Bill Cohen from the Ohio Statehouse News Bureau. They'll talk to me about the state of journalism and how they stay neutral as reporters. That's next time on Writers Talk. Until then, this is Doug Dangler from the Ohio State University saying, keep writing.